from Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org. I'm Nicole Ugrisco with the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, February 19th, 2026. The movement to restore self-governance to Wabanaki nations continued in the Maine legislature today as lawmakers held hearings on a pair of bills designed to put the tribes on the same footing as their federally recognized peers. Similar proposals have stalled in recent years, largely due to opposition from Governor Janet Mills. But as Steve Missler reports, talks are underway that could bring the tribes closer to their goal.
Both measures are designed to overhaul an agreement signed by Wabanaki leaders and the state in 1980 that has limited tribal welfare and economic opportunities ever since. The Mills administration has largely opposed such efforts, but the governor's chief legal counsel, Jerry Reed, told the Judiciary Committee that a compromise is in the works.
I want to be careful in a setting like this not to overpromise, but here I am confident we're going to be able to deliver something for your review.
Leaders from all four tribes confirmed that negotiations have been underway since November. Those talks already produced one breakthrough in a sometimes rocky relationship between Mills and the tribes. In January, she allowed a bill to become law that gives them exclusive rights to operate internet gambling in Maine. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Maine lawmakers have advanced a plan to reduce greenhouse gas pollution from power plants by 90% over 10 years. As Peter McGuire reports, a new bill would reaffirm Maine's participation in a regional system that caps fossil fuel emissions.
The proposal would align Maine with the latest update to the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or RGGI. Phelps Turner with the Conservation Law Foundation says RGGI has halved carbon dioxide pollution from the Northeast's electric sector in almost 20 years.
The idea is to help the states that are participating in the program meet their climate targets.
RGGI makes power plants pay for each ton of pollution they create. That money is turned back to states. Much of the $182 million Maine receives since the program started has been put into energy efficiency programs. The bill faces additional votes in the legislature before heading to Governor Janet Mills' desk. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Peter McGuire.
A new coalition is urging Maine lawmakers to address the state's housing shortage. Build Homes, Build Community announced its legislative agenda at a press conference at the State House in Augusta today. The housing shortage is already limiting Maine's economic growth, says Katie Shorey with Live and Work in Maine.
So what looks like a housing problem quickly becomes a workforce problem. Employers can create jobs. Communities can recruit people. But if there is nowhere attainable to live, the opportunity stops at the front door.
The coalition wants lawmakers to streamline state permitting for new housing projects and remove regulatory barriers. It's also supporting a bill this session to make the affordable housing income tax credit permanent and wants to see housing funding in the budget and in a state bond. Waldoboro Eel Aquaculture Farm, American Unagi, shuttered its operations recently, leaving at least 10 employees behind and a dozen Elver harvesters owed thousands of dollars in payments. Matthew Eddy, the executive director of the Midcoast Council of Governments, says American Unagi was a unique venture, the only one of its kind in North America, and an operation that the state should not let falter.
As a state, if we're really focused on the fishing industry, looking for new and different ways to grow that industry and secure its independence, this was one that was really interesting.
Eddy says mechanical failures with equipment at American Unagi caused it to lose a lot of its market. Litigation against the equipment supplier only provided a settlement of about half of what the company lost, forcing it into bankruptcy last fall. The Maine Department of Marine Resources had no comment on American Unagi's closure. The city of Portland has determined some exempt nonprofits in the city should be paying property tax. City councilors on Monday will get a first look at a program designed to produce payments in lieu of property taxes. Among the affected nonprofits would be Maine Public. Portland Press Herald reporter Andrew Rice has been looking into this and spoke with Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz.
How is it that these nonprofits find themselves facing the loss of a city tax exemption?
It appears that the city is taking a more sort of strict approach, more letter of the law type of thing with how nonprofits meet the exemption. There's multiple categories, but the ones that I've been talking with who are facing having their exemption revoked are saying that they're being told they no longer meet the definition of being a charitable organization. And it seems to stem from the revenue that these organizations are taking in and how they make that revenue, whether it's through the city saying it's weddings and corporate events and things like that are not meeting the definition of those categories to be considered exempt. For example, at the Irish Heritage Center, who I spoke to this week, they said the weddings that they put on each year account for roughly 5% of their revenue. And the executive director there says, you know, this is nonprofit 101 to schedule events to make money for your cause.
And the other thing that's kind of interesting about this is it's not necessarily tied to the definitions of tax-exempt status that are awarded by the federal or state governments.
And I think that that's really the crux of the city's position, is they're saying you can be a nonprofit federally, but you still have to pay property taxes based on if you don't meet what we're saying you have to meet to be tax exempt locally.
All right. You mentioned the Irish Heritage Center in Portland. What are some of the other organizations that are involved in this?
Well, we've only been able to confirm two others. One is you guys at Maine Public, which is a slightly different scenario because Maine Public has never had a tax exempt status in Portland, but apparently Maine Public has applied and been denied three times since buying the former Public Market building 2 years ago. And the other one that we've confirmed is Mayo Street Arts, which is a smaller arts organization in Portland. Apparently there's a total of 17 that in the past year they've revoked, and we have not received the full list.
Can these decisions be legally challenged?
Yeah, I think there's multiple avenues for appeal. One is like you can appeal locally to the assessor's office, and then you can also go into the abatement process, and then at the highest level can seek declaratory relief at the Superior Court.
Talk a little bit about the reaction that you have heard so far from the few organizations that you've been able to identify.
What we've heard is just sort of like shock. Like these organizations we've talked to have just said they've been sort of had the same mission all along. And so I think that's part of why they're very confused about this. And maybe looking around at other cities and saying, why aren't we seeing a flood of other revocations in other cities? Why is this just Portland? And I think that's the big question right now.
On the city council's agenda for Monday, there's an agenda item to create a program for payments in lieu of property tax. What's that all about?
That's something that the city has been looking at for a few years now. It's modeled after similar pilot programs in Boston and other larger cities. And it seems like it's really aimed at trying to get voluntary payments from some of the larger tax-exempt properties in the city. I think they're looking at institutions like MaineHealth and others that have large assessed value.
That's Portland Press Herald reporter Andrew Rice speaking with Erwin Gratz. Unitarian Universalist churches and Quaker meetings are seeing a surge in interest in Maine, which is considered one of the least religious states in the country. But as Nora Sachs reports in her second story on the UU Quaker Revival, new members say they're looking for and finding a sense of community and an inclusive environment with social justice at the core.
This is a potato.
It's a few weeks before Valentine's Day, and at a Quaker Maker Cafe at the historic Durham Friends Meeting House, artist Nancy Buffard is demonstrating the finer points of making stamps out of Yukon Gold potatoes.
I'm carving, I'm using a linoleum cutting tool to carve into the potato, which is very soft.
These monthly maker cafes are open to the public. Tonight, a few dozen folks of all ages, some capital F friends, many not, have come to decorate homemade cards, share a meal, listen to live music, and just hang out.
It doesn't involve being on the internet. We're not on our phones. We're talking to each other. We're working with our hands. So it's a different way of being together. So we have an idea that that's a good thing to do.
This Quaker meeting has been gathering in Durham since 1775. Bouffard got involved about a year ago. Brought up Catholic, she's explored a variety of spiritual practices throughout her life. But there was a moment right after President Trump's second term began when Bouffard realized she needed a different kind of faith community.
And I wanted to be with people who I knew were active and also believed in the real challenge of peace, trying to come at activism peacefully.
Quakerism's commitment to peace and nonviolence dates to the religion's roots in 17th century England. Having had some experience with Quakers before, Bouffard says she knew they could help her.
So I started coming and hanging out here, and I haven't been disappointed.
Bouffard says she's gotten connected with efforts to support Indigenous and immigrant rights. But beyond the activism, she says she's understanding something else, too.
And the power of silence. There's something here very much teaching being quiet.
Quaker meetings typically involve a lot of time being quiet, but also listening to and holding space for those you disagree with.
Where I feel like I'm reactive, you know, just parts of my personality like to be in a place where I can see examples of people I admire, respect, and aspire to. And I find that here.
Kathy Glennon's path to Unitarian Universalism was more of a stumble. We spoke after a volunteer fair in Brunswick.
And I was actually representing the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender group at our church.
Like Bouffard, Glennon was raised Catholic. But eventually, the now retired special education director says she felt like the Catholic Church just wasn't keeping up with changes in society, especially around gender and sexual equality.
I didn't really have, you know, a negative experience with the Catholic Church in so much as what made it not work for me was that, oh, I'm gay. That doesn't seem to fit with them.
Decades passed, and except for a few years as a practicing Buddhist, Glennon says she's always had a spiritual life, but not much of a religious one. A few years ago, a friend invited her to check out the UU Church in Brunswick. Glennon hemmed and hawed, but finally she went.
I liked what I heard, I liked what I saw, and I keep coming. I think that what I was looking for in a faith community was a place where, as a member of the LGBTQ community, I felt welcomed, not just tolerated, and looking for a community that was engaged with the greater community in a way that was not just lip service.
Glennon says at this church, she feels comfortable being exactly who she is.
And every single service we start with, you know, we welcome who you are, whoever you are, who you love, where you're from, how much money is in your pocket, you're welcome here.
The church also helped her to get to know and support other people who are working on a wide spectrum of social justice issues.
I get to be queer, but that's not my only, like, silo. You know, I'm also, like, involved with this activity or that activity or... It's sort of not a single issue thing.
Glennon says now she feels like she's part of a church community that actually practices what it preaches.
I think the vibe is about really focusing on how do our actions and what we do demonstrate the core principle of love. That's what we try to do, and it's hard.
Like Kathy Glennon, Regine Whittlesey joined the UU Church of Brunswick somewhat accidentally. We met after the satellite service at the Evening Star Cinema.
I did not want to belong to a church. I don't want to have anything to do with religion because I think that's the source of evil much of the world. So that took me by surprise to accept the word church in my life.
A retired teacher from France, Whittlesey says she comes from a family of staunch atheists, but she loves singing. So when one of her former students, who happens to be the church's music director, invited her and her husband to join the pop-up choir last year, they said yes.
And we were mind blown by the service. Karma, the minister, is an incredible person, such wisdom and empathy. And so after that, we decided to come back. And so now we are part of the church, but we didn't. It was not really a conscious decision. It happened. And we thought, yes, we need this community in our life. We need to be with people who feel like us, because these are very, very difficult times, and we get a lot of solace from coming here.
Encouraged by the minister and other members to get more involved politically, they're not only calling their elected officials and going to protests, but also supporting a bill that would require the state to divest funds from perpetrators of international human rights violations.
It's a small act of resistance to go testify, but we felt like we're doing our part.
Whittlesey says these days, instead of staying home with her head in her hands, she looks forward to Sunday church services.
We've never been afraid to try new things, so, you know, we're open. And I'm really glad we are, because we found a good place.
Now, she just has to figure out how to explain this change of heart to her family back in France. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Nora Sachs.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Coming up on Maine Calling at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, winter birding. I'm Nicole Ogrisco. Thanks for listening.